first, you know, come onto a retreat, you got all these pressures and all these burdens and all these worries and all these concerns. You're a prisoner of the past, prisoner of the future, prisoner of all your thoughts and all that sort of stuff. And you surprise yourself little by little, all that starts to fade away. And you feel this great sense of lightness and freedom. And you get happy, which means it's very easy to laugh. And be careful, because, you know, when I tell a funny story or tell a joke which is even half funny, I'm looking at you. And if you don't laugh, I mean, you've got big problems with your hindrances. So I can tell those people are getting good meditation, because they laugh easily. I didn't know what I was going to talk about, so I came in here today. As usual, there you go, laughing. I didn't say anything funny. So, just going in, I thought I'd just talk about the importance of happiness for meditation. Because this is, again, something which is in the teachings of the Buddha. But, you know, when you first read these teachings of the Buddha, that, you know, you skip over some of them. It seems that you don't just notice them. They're right in front of you, but you just don't see it. And just later on, you've been a monk for a long time, you've been meditating a long time, and sometimes you get the sort of the message when your meditations go well, when they don't go well, and you see that with all the other people, you know, my fellow meditators, the monks or the nuns, you see it with the people you support, the lay people who you teach and who confide in. You can actually see just those people who get sort of the nice meditations. And it gets quite obvious. It's those ones who develop happiness get much better meditation and have a much better time on the way to enlightenment. A much faster way. So this path is actually a happy path. A path of ever-increasing happiness. Not indulgence, because if you indulge, you can't really enjoy things. But if you really sort of learn how just to be in this moment and just be with things as they happen, and just carry a few burdens in life, then you actually do find you get happier and happier and happier. And I often think, just, you know, why did, you know, when the Buddha started teaching these things, why did it become so popular? Why did that become a world religion? Because he didn't go around slaughtering people and making them convert to being a Buddhist. You know, he did give them the fear of hell. If you don't become a Buddhist, you will go to hell in the fiery furnace where you'll be poked with sticks, you'll be boiled in oil. And people actually like that stuff. They like sort of, you know, just to see just all these different ways of torturing things. Because that's what you see in the temples in Thailand. You see all these pictures. They've got the heaven realms. But at eye level, that's where they have the hell realms, because that's what people like to watch. It's really weird, people. But anyway, you notice that. So, you know, it's like in the days they didn't have movies, you know, they used to have the temple paintings, and that was like the horror movies, which they used to go and watch. But anyhow, well, how did I get into that? Anyway, the way you sort of, you look at the Buddha, and he didn't sort of threaten people, it was a beautiful path which just said, you know, look at me, I've been meditating, I'm happy, why don't you try and do the same? And that's actually how meditation, how Buddhism has actually spread in the world. You know, not because of so much a philosophical teaching, although sometimes people like their philosophy, but in the end, because it makes people happier and happier and happier. And today I'm going to ask you to cultivate that happiness. And don't just take it for granted, but just to see how happy you can be. So as well as just developing peace, or developing mindfulness, or developing loving kindness, how about developing happiness? And of course that's something you can develop. You can actually recognize it. Now today, on this retreat, are you happy? If so, why? Where did that happiness come from? Now one of the sources of happiness which the Buddha encouraged people to develop, it was this incredibly powerful meditation technique of the perception of emptiness. So this was in the Chulasanyata Sutta, where he said, "No, monks, when you're in the forest, just remember just what this forest is empty of. And if you're a monk, you're empty of wives and kids. Oh, you know, I hate it when it's the school holidays, because people always bring their kids to Bodhinyana Monastery. Running around, screaming, creating all these sorts of noise. And I get a lot of sympathy for you guys who have to live with that 24 hours a day. For me, it's only just for an hour to a day, and they're screaming, running around. And you think, oh, the kids are so sweet and so lovely. Oh, my goodness, my ears after. That is why, you know, sort of in places like Sri Lanka or sort of even Thailand, they have these temporary ordinations, like in Malaysia. And, no, I've been very strict not to allow this in Bodhinyana Monastery. Because all it is that you get rid of your kids for 2 weeks. You send them to the monastery so they can learn Buddhism. And so mum and dad can have a free time. They can 2 weeks holiday, 2 weeks, they can do whatever they want. They can go out at night, they don't have to worry about the kids. So all it really is free daycare for 2 weeks for your kids as you teach them Buddhism. So, no, it's okay to have kids. No, you don't mind seeing the kids, but as long as it's not for more than 1 hour. But one of the problems is... you've seen me do this in sort of in Nala Maha. It's a Thai tradition. It's not a Sri Lankan tradition, but it's a Thai tradition. If you get a new baby, now you own it. It's not one you buy in the shop. But if you get a new baby, well, you know that old joke about this person who's one of these refugees who came from Afghanistan, you know, into Australia. And as soon as they get into Australia, you know, they have to be, you know, shown around, you know, about how to use the ATMs, you know, sort of what the traffic rules are. And one of the things they were shown by the social worker was the supermarket. And so they don't have supermarkets in Afghanistan, not in the sort of rough places where all these refugees come. So, you know, this really surprised. These are going, amazing variety of food, and there's some things they've never seen before. So, you know, he had like this instant mashed potato. It's just like a powder. I said, well, how do you do this? He said, oh, you just get that powder, you add water, and you get potato. So that's amazing. In our country, you had to actually plow the earth. You got them out of the soil. That's where you got paper plates from. And they went somewhere else and had milk powder. What's this? Milk powder. He said, it's the same thing. You put the powder in a pot and you add water, you get milk. Wow, it's amazing, because in our country, milk comes from the cow. And you can imagine what he thought when he went down another aisle, he saw baby powder. They're really great in the West. In our country, it comes out of a wife. Anyhow, where was I? Forget that. Sorry? Happiness, yeah, okay. <That's good. laughs> So that was actually why sort of Buddhism became very popular, because, no, look, I don't know about you, but, you know, I was brought up as a nominal Christian. And every now and again you go to a church, and one of the first things I noticed in the church, the seats were so hard. They never had upholstery on those wooden pews. And you could see that just they were so old, and they were so shiny. You know why they're so shiny? Because during the sermon, people were rushing this way and that way, fidgeting all over the place. 100 years of that, and of course it's shiny. And it was so cold. And so this was in England. And there was no heating in there. And everything was just, you know, very ascetic. And, you know, straight away, the idea there was you're not supposed to enjoy yourself. And if there was a sermon, they would never, ever tell a joke. No one would ever laugh at church. As if you did giggle, you got thrown out. And to me, that was just, you know, it was so sour. So sort of no life of happiness. And of course, that never attracted me at all. But when you started seeing these monks, you know, giving talks, these were actually happy people. And that was actually a revelation to see that religion could be happy. And of course, that's one of the reasons why sort of Buddhism grows. Some of these are why you come here. Because, you know, you don't want to have a miserable life. Life is enough suffering at home anyway. You know, at work, you have enough trouble there. So you want to come to religion, actually, to let go of your burdens, to be free. So spiritual life is really trying to understand life so you can become happy. And what's the use of knowledge? if it doesn't make you free and happy and peaceful. So that's why at university, if I wanted knowledge, you could actually go much further in knowledge at university than you can do in a meditation monastery. Well, maybe not, but a different type of knowledge. But the pursuit of knowledge, that was the places where you had most resources. But that was one of the things which I noticed. Hardly anyone was happy there. Again, all these great professors, because at a place like Cambridge, you can actually meet great professors. But, you know, they weren't happy. They never actually struck you as if they knew the meaning of life or anything close to it. So yeah, they knew a lot, but they understood very, very little. They didn't have that peace and that happiness, which I thought the knowledge would give you. And hopefully, if you come here, if this place is worth anything, you go back happier than when you came. And this is usually what happens. I think this time last year, one of the meditators, she's not here, she was from Sydney, and she came from the meditation retreat last November, and afterwards she wrote the letter back, saying that when she got back to work, she had to really beg her boss to give her the week off. But the boss was so impressed, he hadn't any idea what meditation or Buddhism was about, but he said, well, whatever you've been taking, can you bring me back some next time? Because he thought it was happiness, you know, she saw it was happiness. And a similar story I remember when I was visiting my mother in UK, in England, and it just so happened that there was going to be a ceremony in one of the prisons in England. One of the monks over there, he'd been visiting the prisons a long time, and one of the prisoners there and this monk, they got together. It was one of these open prisons. And they got permission. You can imagine how hard it was to get a big Buddha statue in the grounds of the prison and make what they called a Buddha grove. You know, a place, you know, where people would go just for a bit of peace and quiet and serenity for people who were in jail for some terrible crimes. And as Buddhists, I mean, you know, the symbol of a Buddha is one of peace and calm. That's why you have all the Buddhas in the gardens. And in the garden centres over in Perth and Melbourne and all these other places, see all these little stone Buddha statues which people have in their gardens. I never see any picture of Jesus on a cross in people's gardens. That's true, isn't it? Why is that? Because it's a symbol of peace and calmness and gentleness. Even like, look, about 23 years ago, I went to one of the Christian schools here in Perth. It was All Saints. That's over in Bull Creek, or just by Bull Creek somewhere. I went to give a talk there, you know, about Buddhism. And after giving the talk, I went back to the principal, said, no, come to my office for a cup of tea. So I went to his office just for a cup of tea and a little bit of a chat, and he had a desk there. There was not much on his desk except a Buddha statue. I asked him, what are you doing with a Buddha statue there? He said, you know, you're a Christian. You're a Christian school. Does your board of directors know about this? And he said, yeah, I'm not a Buddhist, but it keeps me peaceful in the stress of my work. And I thought, wow, you know, that even in a Christian school you had a Buddha statue there just to keep people peaceful. And you may have heard me tell this story, which is even more incredible, but true. One of our monks was visiting England, and, you know, he's an Australian monk, so he'd never seen a castle before. So everyone has to go and see a castle when you go to England. So they went to the castle, but it was closed. Got the wrong day. So the host said, oh, where else can we take you? And not far away was the country home of the British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, Chartwell. So let's take you there. So he went to this home of the British Prime Minister, wartime Prime Minister, Winston Churchill. And they had to pay an entrance fee, of course. And once they got through the door, straight on the right-hand side in the lobby was this painting of a Buddha statue done by Winston Churchill. And because he was a monk, he sort of asked, what's that doing there? I never knew that Winston Churchill painted Buddha statues. And the curator said, well, actually, that Buddha statue was actually owned by Winston Churchill. I think it got broken somewhere along the line, but that was the statue he had by his bedside, on his bedside table throughout the Second World War, which gave him a sense of peace and hope during the darkest days of that huge conflict in Europe. And he said before he broke it, he painted a picture of it because he loved it very much. And there it was. There, a famous person also used a Buddha statue to give him hope and encouragement and peace. So amazing, just the power of these Buddha statues, just not just for ordinary people, but just for, not just for Buddhists, but for other people as well. And just on that same point, I remember going, the last time I went to go visit the college in Cambridge where I lived for all those years. It was Emmanuel College. And I, just outside the senior common room, that's where all the dons go and have their meals, again, a Buddha statue. And that wasn't there when I was there. So I didn't know where that had come from. And I asked around, no one knew where that had come from. This beautiful Burmese Buddha statue was just right outside the senior common room. But I also noticed that since my time, I have to say this, since my time, in my time the cottage was like a middle cottage. But in those years, ever since that Buddha statue was put in that junior common room, Emmanuel College went up the league tables. And I think the year I saw that Buddha statue, it was actually academically the top college in Cambridge. And now I know why. Because of the Buddha statue there. So these things have power. So anyway, going back to that that prison. So they decided to put a Buddha statue in the prison. You know, so any prisoner could go there, and it was a quiet place. They could just go there and contemplate and get some peace and get some encouragement. Because you understand the shame, the guilt, the pain of being a prisoner. You know, you're facing, you know, the result of what you did, and you're taken away from all your loved ones, and it doesn't matter how comfortable you may think it is, that will never replace your freedom to come and go. So it's always a great punishment to be inside a jail. So there you had a place of peace. And the monk and this prisoner, they managed to get permission from the Home Office, which must have been an incredibly painstaking, difficult thing, to have this thing put into the prison. The prisoners actually made a nice garden around it, and now we were going to celebrate the opening. So I just happened to be there, so I got myself an invite. And it was just so inspiring. You know, for me, a Buddhist, I know how powerful the Buddha is. You know, just an image, a symbol, just to take away a heap of pain and give a lot of peace and happiness to people. I thought, what an incredibly powerful, wonderful thing this is to have inside a prison. So during the ceremony, which started just at dusk, we were doing, you know, the typical circumambulation with flowers and candles and incense, walking around this Buddha statue. And I was high. I was so happy and inspired. And I did, out of the corner of my eye, see two of these prisoners. Because you know what happens, most people aren't really interested, but they're just going, they've got nothing else to do, nothing on TV that night, so they're just having a look, see what's going on. And I saw a couple of these prisoners looking at me, and I heard one turn to another, pointing to me, saying, "He's on the gear." And the gear means on drugs. Because they saw my smile, and they couldn't believe it could be natural. As far as they were concerned, I was on heroin. But I was on something much better than heroin. I was on Buddhism. I was on inspiration. I was on happiness. And so throughout my whole monastic life, I deliberately developed that happiness. I haven't avoided it. When it's come up, I've encouraged it. I've celebrated it. I've nurtured it. I've generated it. Why not? That gives me powerful meditation. And again, you've noticed those monks, those nuns, those lay people who do cultivate happiness, they're the ones who have the deep meditation. I'm not quite sure what comes first, the happiness or the deep meditation, or the deep meditation and the happiness, but I know they actually work together as a pair. So I'm mentioning this because some of you in the interviews have said, "I get dull. Yeah, I'm peaceful, but it's dull, I fall asleep." And there's something missing in your meditation, the development of happiness. And it's not that hard to develop. You've already seen me teaching you how to be happy. In the mornings, just after the chanting, when you're still half asleep, you haven't had your breakfast yet. In the evenings, when you're tired after a long day's of meditation. sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. It's making you smile even now. See, this is actually giving happiness into three ordinary sadhus. So that's what you should do when you get out of bed in the morning. Don't go, oh God, another day. 4 o'clock in the morning, what am I doing this for? You know, even in prison you don't have to get up till 6 o'clock. And then I've got to go 4 o'clock and I've got no TV, I can't get another breakfast for a couple of hours. Why not? This is unfair. So don't do that. Instead we develop the happiness. So you jump out of bed in the morning. Zippity-doo-dah! Another day at Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat. Another day when I can get in line. Woo! If that doesn't work... just sit there and think, I don't have to go to work today. The perception of emptiness. I don't have to get in that car and just rush through the traffic. I don't need to actually to fight my way onto the public transport. I don't need to rush my breakfast. And I don't need to, you know, worry about getting into the toilet before my wife gets in there because you spend so much time in there and I've got to go. Isn't it wonderful? You're totally free. You've got your own loo. You can sit on there as long as you like. And no one's going to bang on the door. Aren't you finished yet? Aren't you finished yet? So you appreciate what you have. You develop that perception of beauty. What a wonderful thing it is just to be here, to be alive, to be meditating, to have a day which you are totally devoting just to the pursuit of happiness inside and peace. Not a happiness which depends on other things, but a happiness which is built on the absence of things. Simplicity. And this is a wonderful opportunity. You all know that there is, what's a waiting list of about 40 before they stop the waiting list for this retreat? You've made it. Yeah. So enjoy it while you're here. And if you cultivate that enjoyment, right from the very morning. Don't just say, oh, I've just got to get up now. Look, you know, you've got to get up anyway, so enjoy it. Put energy into it. Zippity-doodle, do something. Just go in there and just when you're brushing your teeth, you know, brush your teeth with joy. Up and down, up and down. Whatever. I don't know about you, but when you brush your teeth, where do you start? Are you that mindful? Are you just a creature of habit, always starting at the same position in your mouth every morning, every evening, however many times? How can you be happy like that? You're just a zombie. So I teach people on retreats to live on the wild side. Do something wild. Start brushing your teeth on the opposite side of the mouth. May you try that. So, okay, this morning, the top right, top left. The bottom, tomorrow or this evening, I'm going to start at the top right. Tomorrow morning, bottom left, bottom middle. You'll find just doing something as simple as that wakes you up. You're putting some fun into the simple things of life, which bring you energy, joy. You just... being playful. When you're playful, it means you're engaging in what's happening in front of you. When you're playful, it means you're generating joy and fun. And when you do that, when you're sort of having your breakfast, I don't know what you eat for breakfast, but maybe just for fun, you know, just on your toast, you know, maybe the left third of it, put marmalade, the middle third, put some Vegemite, and the right half, you know, put some banana or something. Just for fun. Try it, because you do things like that, you're actually bringing up energy and happiness into your life. But if you always do the same thing, you just sit there and you can see people at breakfast, you know, they're really dull. They're just munching these things, putting them in their mouth, looking down at the plate, just munching something else. They've been eating the same thing every day for years. They're just total zombies. They don't know what they're doing because they've got no fun, enjoyment. They're not engaging with it. So try and do things in a different way. Because if you do things in a different way, it's called encouraging mindfulness. Because your mindfulness gets very dull if you do things the same way all the time. It means you're not alive. It's like you go through the same door every day. You're just a creature of habit. And creatures of habit, they get very, very dull. You know, just like in your relationships, you know, which you have with your partner. If you always do things the same way, the relationship dies. There's no excitement, there's no difference anymore, it's just predictable. What type of relationship is that with yourself? You're totally predictable. So try and do things in a slightly different way. So in these retreats, you're allowed to be eccentric. You're allowed to do walking meditation on one leg. Hop, hop, hop. If you've got sloth and torpor, that really helps. You're allowed to meditate sitting the other way. Why do you always have to sit this way? Now, what you actually do, you try it. And when you do it differently, you find actually you're more awake, more alert, it's more fun. And when it's more fun, you get engaged. The energy level goes up, the happiness level goes up, the mindfulness level goes up. And this is just to generate the fun. So you go for a walk. Don't always go for a walk the same place. Just, no, it's not your walk. Go for different places. Just experiment and find out what's going on. When you go for a walk, it's very nice to go for a walk having no directions. So you're not even more than one step ahead of yourself. Not that I'm going to go over there. So I'm going to make this one step, that's all. And once this one step is finished, then I'll decide which way to go next. And that way you can actually explore, because you don't know where you're going to go. You see another path, even though I was going to go over there, you see another path, well, let's go this way. And that is very, very good for gaining insight. Because when you set yourself a path, I'm going to go to, say, the garden down by the lake, another interesting path may come up, you'll ignore it because you've already set where you want to go. You're too far in the future, you've got two solid plans. Insight is where you go down a different way you've never been before. A different path for your mind. So you see something totally different from another perspective. Isn't that amazing? So do your insight practice when you're just going for a leisurely walk. Have no idea where you're going to go. Just one step at a time, and then we'll see what happens. If you can do that, then even when you're meditating, just this one breath. Where I am now, you're not planning where you're going to go to next. You know that gets very fun, when you don't know what's going to happen next, you don't know where you're going to go, you don't know where you're going to end up. You're just exploring. You're getting this beautiful inquisitiveness, which actually gives rise to seeing new things in different ways. And it also gives rise to a sense of energy and happiness and joy. So, and also, when you're eating your food today, I haven't said yet about the one spoon at a time practice. This is a wonderful method of enjoying your food and getting better digestion and also becoming much more mindful. Because what most people do, you can see that, look at other people when they're eating today at lunchtime, because they probably forget this by the time lunch comes. You'll see them there with, you know, a mouthful of food, chewing it. And they'll be messing around on their plate. They're not paying any attention to what they're actually eating. They're just thinking of what they're going to have next. And messing things around. How can you be messing things around on a plate and paying attention to what's in your mouth at the same time? And you know, if you really pay attention to the taste of the food, if you're fully mindful of it, that's actually when all the saliva, the bile, all these other secretions actually come out of the body, because you're aware of what's happening. But if you're not aware at all of what's happening, basically you're not tasting the food. It's not registered in the brain, and so the brain doesn't really know you're eating, so how can it sort of secrete all this stuff to digest it? So the more you're aware of what you're eating, the more it gets digested. That's just science. Ajahn Brahm science, not probably real science, but it makes sense to me. So, when you're eating the food, one mouthful at a time. And you've seen other people, actually they're worse than that. They've got one mouthful in their mouth, and they've got one waiting on their spoon in line. And the other hand is heaping up the third one, while they're already looking at the fourth. They're about three mouthfuls in front of themselves. Now, is that mindfulness? Is that living in the present moment? Are you really enjoying your food? Actually, you're not even eating it. You're planning what's going to come next into your mouth. No wonder people have bad digestion. So, one spoon at a time. Eat this first of all. Forget about what you're going to have next until you finish swallowing this. That's very nice. Now, what shall I have next? You'll enjoy your food more. And number two, you'll digest much better because you're paying attention to what's happening. It's just more fun. And again, it gives you the training in being in the moment as well. Because being in the moment is where all the fun is. Now, happiness is not in the future. All of you think, once I get nimittas, then I'll be happy. Ha 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 ha. No way. Once I get enlightened, then I'll be happy. You'll never get enlightened. So be happy now. This is good enough. This is all I have. Just this moment now. This moment is meant to be karmically created. Just so. Here it is. Enjoy. That tastes nice. Another story over in one of the books there. It's a classic Buddhist story which I adapted, about this guy who was running through the forest. And he's running through the forest because he was being chased by a tiger. This big, man-eating tiger. And of course, a tiger was catching up on him. Literally was on his heels. And he thought he was going to die. But at the last moment, he saw a well in the middle of the jungle. So he just jumped in. He jumped in because he didn't know anything else to do. He realized, as soon as he jumped in, he'd made a big mistake. Because that well was dry, no water in the bottom. Instead, in the bottom was this huge black snake. Intuitively, he grasped at the side of the well, where he found a tree root. And he clung to that tree root for his life. It broke his fall. And when he came to his senses, he looked down. He'd woken up that snake. And the snake had lifted up its head, opened its hood. Did I scare you? No, I think you know me already. It's really, when people don't know me, I can really get them. Get them scared, have really good fun. So look, I enjoy, this is talk about happiness. You know how much I enjoy giving talks. I have great fun with you guys. Anyway. He was trying to bite this poor man's feet. But his feet were just too high, only just too high. The snake's tried to stretch himself, trying to get higher to catch his feet because it was only a couple of inches away. But he was just a bit too high for the snake. So at least he was safe there for the time being. And then he looked up. The tiger hadn't given up that easy. The tiger was actually leaning over the well, with his paw trying to paw him from above. But the hand which was holding the root was just too low. The tiger was stretching, trying to get the hand, but just couldn't reach it. So again, he had the tiger above him, and the snake below him, but at least he was safe for the time being, just to catch his breath. But then something which really terrified him happened. Out from a hole in the side of the well came two mice, a black mouse and a white mouse, and started chewing at his root, making it thinner and thinner and thinner. He didn't know how long that root would hold his weight. The snake above, below him, hadn't given up. Neither had the tiger. He couldn't climb out. And the root was getting thinner and thinner and thinner. But another unexpected thing happened. Because the tiger was trying to paw him from above, the backside of the tiger was rubbing against the tree, making it shake. The tree had a branch which overhung the well. And on that branch, just above the opening to the well, there was a bee's nest. Doesn't worry, the bees wouldn't go down the well, but the honey did. And so honey started dripping down the well. And the man put his tongue out and tasted the honey. It was so sweet, and he enjoyed it so much. And that is the end of the story. And that's a classic Buddhist story. Now, that's a great story because it's true to life. Your life doesn't have endings, does it? You get one problem out of the way, and there's one more problem coming up next. Your life doesn't have a finish to it. Even when you die, it's not ending. You have to come back again, and here we go again. So life is not just this one episode which finishes. It's like the old soap operas. There's so many interlocking stories. When one finishes, another one just starts again. But many times your life is like that, between a snake and a tiger. Down, you die. Up, you die. You're really in big trouble. And your tenuous hold on safety is being eaten away by the black and white mice standing for night and day, ever taking away your tenuous hold on safety. But there's always honey dripping down in life. That's so delicious. And the moral of that story is, when the honey drops, don't be concerned about the snake or the tiger. Don't worry about the past and the future. Don't take all these burdens of your life and mean you can't enjoy the honey dripping down. Enjoy that honey. That tastes delicious. Cultivate that pleasure, that happiness, that joy. It's here all the time. But when we're worrying about, what's going to happen when we get home? What's going to happen when Ajahn Brahm goes and have to meditate again? Can't he entertain us for a bit longer? No, just enjoy the moment. When there's happiness there, enjoy it. Because even though that's where the story ended when I read it, of course, I always add my ending, which you probably know from Opening the Door of Your Heart. Because my ending, and it's a logical ending, it could happen. I always imagine that snake. The snake tried, will never give up. So I'm stretching, and the tiger just stretched over as well. But when you stretch over a well, you've got to be careful. You might lose your balance and fall in, which is what the tiger did. The tiger fell into the well. Fortunately, it missed the man, but fell on top of the snake. Crushed the snake to death and broke its own neck. So, with the tiger dead and the snake dead, the man could, after, when he at his leisure, could slowly climb out of the well and go to safety. He didn't need to worry after all. And that's much of our life is like that. All the stuff we worry about and concern ourselves about, what might happen if this happens, and what might happen if that happens. A lot of time, nothing happens. Which means you didn't have to worry anyway. And if you're wise, you can always enjoy the honey. You might as well, if you're going to get eaten or bitten by a snake, you might as well enjoy yourself while you've got some time. So that is actually how we meditate. We learn how to enjoy the present moment. There's beautiful forest out there. Amazing birds, the red-tailed black cockatoos. Endangered species, very rare. And they seem to be hanging around this place. I wonder why. But anyhow, they're beautiful birds. It's a beautiful day. Not too hot, not too cold in the middle of the day. You've got beautiful places. So develop that happiness and joy. And if you develop that happiness and joy during the day, you will find it much easier when you close your eyes and sit on your backside and start to meditate. You start with joy. Because you start with joy, you're just really happy to be here. You can play with your mind, play with your breath. So your mind is your playmate. I don't know if you had playmates when you were young. Kids you'd always hang out with, go to the park, get into trouble with, your playmates. You know, you're always, you know, with each other. I remember some of my old friends, we used to play around in the local park, get into trouble. I'd asked somebody the other day, what's the worst thing you ever did? You know, one of the worst things I ever did, I made a bomb once with my friend. I was about 10 years of age. He was this chemistry genius. I just, you know, egged him on. So I made this bomb, and we were bang in the park. It was really exciting. Until the park keeper caught us. That wasn't exciting. Boys being boys, blowing things up. That's what we love to do. Only these days with terrorists, it takes all the fun out of breaking bombs. But anyway, that's what I did when I was a kid. But anyway, it didn't hurt anybody, just, you know, just messing around. But anyway, you had your playmates, so you're always hanging out with them. And it's the same if you have a playmate, your mind is your playmate. And you're always hanging out with it. So you're sitting down here. Okay, mind, what should we do today? Oh yeah, you've been really having, we've had a great day so far. What should we do? Shall we play? Let's play limiters today. So they play limiters, gets a nice limiter. With that degree of like fun, you're actually engaging with things. Unfortunately, when people lose a sense of fun, they get too serious, they get so negative, and nothing is nice, it doesn't engage you anymore. That's why the only way that dull, negative people can actually pay any attention is with effort. And they have to struggle, it's so hard and harsh, and they never get very far. But the happy people, they can just relax, and the happiness is the glue which keeps you in the moment. That is what sticks you into stillness. If you're happy being here, it's easy. So you develop that happiness in the meditation. If you look at the Buddha's words in the suttas, this is exactly what he said. He called it a gradual path, because once there was this king, Ajatasattu, who just knocked off his father and killed the father for the throne. He got into trouble later on for that. But King Ajatasattu killed his father and took over the throne. And once he became a king, one evening he said, well, you know, it's usually what kings do on the full moon night to go and see these, you know, religious people. You know, so he asked his friend, do you know any religious people around here, you know, can go and see this evening? And of course he asked this Dr. Jivaka. And Jivaka said, yeah, the Buddha's just, you know, in the bamboo grove. And so he said, okay, I'll go and see him. So he went to see the Buddhas, and after a long little story. And when he got into the hall where the Buddha was, he just asked a question. He said, look, you know, what the hell are you doing this for, being a monk? You know, you came from a royal family. You could be enjoying all the wonderful places, the harem, the food and everything like I am. And the Buddha said, I have much more happiness than you have. And that really shocked the king, because he always thought that, you know, if you're a king with all the money and the power, you can have as much happiness as you want. So what do you mean? And he started talking about what we call the gradual path. He said, but when you start, you know, doing little things like keeping precepts and being kind, being generous, it gives you lots of happiness. And that actually, when I first read that, that resonated. It told me something which I suspected, but which no one had actually put into words before. That if you're a good person, you have a good time. But what most people think, if you keep precepts, it means you're sacrificing something. You're sacrificing your happiness. You can't have fun. And that's what most people say. If you give up alcohol, how can you have fun? You can't enjoy yourself. Come on, let go. Have fun. Get drunk like me. That's ridiculous. You have much more fun when you don't get drunk. I've told that to, you know, the youth groups. Because I remember parties. You know, you go to parties or dances or whatever, nightclubs. And look, you know, what do boys go to nightclubs for? They go there for the girls. What do the girls go there for? For the boys. So, you know, once you manage to find one and you like each other, then what do? You just find a nice corner somewhere, you know, to hanky-panky. Well, you know what I mean, hanky-panky is. I don't know, you know about what, how far a monk should go, but anyway, hanky-panky is good enough for the time being. And I remember the times when I used to drink, the best part of the parties was the part I couldn't remember. And I thought, I'm missing out on something here. But I tell these young people, don't drink. Then the best part of the party, you're totally aware, mindful, when you're in the corner with the girl or the boy, you can really enjoy it. So actually, alcohol takes away your enjoyment. You don't know what you're doing. So whatever you're doing in life, you keep the precepts, actually you're much happier. You have more fun in life. It's as if, yeah, sure, you have your ups and downs in life, just like the waves on the ocean, but actually the tide goes up the more you keep your precepts. And when somebody explained that you're keeping precepts for happiness, you're being moral for the sake of fun, that was radical for me. Because I heard before, especially from my Christian upbringing, you keep the precepts, you keep the morality so you can be happy after you die. And now I was being told, no, you keep those precepts and morality so you're happy right now. And it showed that this spiritual path, this religious path, actually was to create more happiness in your life. And of course, when I started, that actually worked. I didn't, you know, start smiling a lot when I was at school, at university. And I didn't know why, but it was because of my meditation, also my precepts. It made everything very easy. So you have a gradual path of happiness. Keeping 5 precepts, keeping 8 precepts, keeping 20 precepts, 100 precepts, how many precepts you can give, accumulate them. And also just being kind, being generous. I get so much happiness out of just being kind, being generous. So, you know, sometimes say, oh, I don't blame you, working so hard for us, you're giving up all this time, what do you do that for? I do it for fun, you know that. So the more actually you give, the more fun you have. So you're developing happiness. But I also notice that sometimes I used to catch myself complaining. Why do I have to teach all these retreats? Why do I have to sit down in interviews and listen to all this rubbish? Why do I have to go and just answer the telephone? Why do I have to... What was it? I just came out of my 15-day retreat in my cave. Oh, just blissed out, just so peaceful, so lovely. And of course, I came out just before tea time, and at tea time there was a telephone call. Ajahn Brahm, I'm having trouble with my marriage. Should I leave my husband? Because, you know, I left him once before, but it really didn't work out, but then I came back to him again, and I think he loves me, but maybe he doesn't love me, but we do argue sometimes. And, you know, actually once he hit me, and should I do this? I've just come out of retreat. Why me? And I caught myself like that and said, oh, come off it. You know, just, you know, this is just part of the course. You have to do this, so it's like it or lump it again. You know, on the phone, you might as well have fun and enjoy it. So sometimes I catch myself with fault-finding and getting into negativity. But I realise, look, that is just a stupid thing to do. Getting negative and complaining, just the floor's too hard, the cushions are too soft, the food's too good. You know, people actually complain like that to me. This is too nice a meditation retreat center. We should take away the cushions. Come on, get really tough. You know, instead of actually breakfast in the morning, we just have like bread and water, not toast. And just for lunch, just rice and just, you know, a couple of vegetables instead of all this choice. We should really be tough. Come on, no messing around. Enlightenment or bust. And we should just, not 4 o'clock in the morning, I should get everybody out at 3:30. And if you're not here at 3:30, you get flogged. Let's really go for it. And of course, that's totally ridiculous. But you know, some people are like that. They actually complain it's too soft in this place. And some of them think, you can't do anything right. It's... You know, you try and make it very nice and it's too soft. You know, you try and make it and it's not good enough, and then people complain it's just, you know, the air conditioner's not on, or it should be on, it should be warm, it should be cold. Ajahn Brahm, can't you do something about the weather? Why do you let it rain? And people like that, they always complain no matter what happens in life. They always find something to complain about. Now those are the people who will never get anywhere in meditation. It's called the fault-finding mind. It's the opposite of happiness. Happiness is gratitude. You feel so amazingly grateful that you've got a place you can meditate in. And all the people, you know, including myself, will work their butts off to get this place together. And all the work you did to actually to get here, all your good karma and the stuff which you've been doing, the people in our Buddhist society who run this, you know, this joint. Wow, isn't that amazing and wonderful? You feel so much gratitude. Gratitude for yourself. You've had the guts to come on a meditation retreat, you know, to get all this stuff together so you can come here. Well done, me. And well done, everybody. And when you have that mind of gratitude, that's the opposite of fault finding. That is a mind of happiness. And you know, you can always turn that happiness on whenever you want. That's what I do. Now, sometimes I do get tired. Sometimes you get sick. So what do? Instead of getting fault-finding, oh, I'm sick again, this sucks. Why do I have to get sick? I've got to teach today, I've got all this stuff to do, this is unfair, why does it always happen to me? Instead of fault-finding, I go into this habit, whoopee, I'm sick today. Yeah, I can lay down and have a good rest today. I don't have to sort of keep getting up. So I enjoy being sick. It's great fun. Do you enjoy sickness? Why not? You know, it gives other people an opportunity to look after you and be kind to you. Because that's what we do when I'm sick. If I cough too many times, by the next couple of hours I've got all this medicine in front of me. It does, it happens. I think I coughed in Notre Dame a couple of weeks ago. And go, what is this? It's really good fun because people are just so kind. They just want to give you something. And, you know, me coughing gives them an opportunity to be kind. So you being sick gives other people an opportunity to show their compassion towards you. It's really great fun. Sickness is this wonderful way of allowing people to show how much they care for you. So when I look at it that way, I don't find fault with the sickness. It's a wonderful blessing. It's what a beautiful part of human nature is to be sick so that other people can look after us and care for us. So I don't even find fault with that. So you don't find fault with things. You know, people sort of try and ask you stupid questions in the Q&A in the evening. Yeah, sometimes I stuff up and don't recognize it's a joke question. Sometimes I do.